You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the March 2018 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. 20 years ago, shame and scandal enveloped our society. An unknown woman, me, stood at the center of it. In the era of Time's Up, I'm no longer alone. Hashtag Me Too and Me by Monica Lewinsky. Opening photograph by Eric Madigan Heck. Monica Lewinsky in New York City last month. How do I know him? Where have I seen him? The man in the hat looked familiar, I thought, as I peered over at him a second time. It was Christmas Eve, 2017. My family and I were about to be seated at a quaint restaurant in Manhattan's West Village. We had just come from Gramercy Park on the one night each year when the exclusive park, accessible only to nearby residents with special keys, opens its gates to outsiders. There had been carols. People had sung with abandon. In short, it was a magical night. I was happy. Amid the glow of candles and soft lighting, I strained to look again at the man in the hat. He was part of a small group that had just exited the main dining room. They were now gathering their belongings, likely vacating what was to be our table. And then it clicked. He looks just like... No, couldn't be. Could it? A student of karma, I found myself seizing the moment. Whereas a decade ago I would have turned and fled the restaurant at the prospect of being in the same place as this man, many years of personal counseling work, both trauma-specific and spiritual, had led me to a place where I now embrace opportunities to move into spaces that allow me to break out of old patterns of retreat or denial. At the same moment, I stepped toward the man in the hat and began to ask, "You're not..." He stepped toward me with a warm, incongruous smile and said, "Let me introduce myself. I'm Ken Starr." An introduction was indeed necessary. This was, in fact, the first time I had met him. I found myself shaking his hand, even as I struggled to decipher the warmth he evinced. After all, in 1998, this was the independent prosecutor who had investigated me, a former White House intern. The man whose staff, accompanied by a group of FBI agents, Starr himself was not there, had hustled me into a hotel room near the Pentagon and informed me that unless I cooperated with them, I could face 27 years in prison. This was the man who had turned my 24-year-old life into a living hell in his effort to investigate and prosecute President Bill Clinton on charges that would eventually include obstruction of justice and lying under oath, lying about having maintained a long-term extramarital relationship with me. Ken Starr asked me several times if I was doing okay. A stranger might have surmised from his tone that he had actually worried about me over the years. His demeanor, almost pastoral, was somewhere between avuncular and creepy. He kept touching my arm and elbow, which made me uncomfortable. I turned and introduced him to my family. Bizarre as it may sound, I felt determined then and there to remind him that 20 years before, he and his team of prosecutors hadn't hounded and terrorized just me, but also my family, threatening to prosecute my mom if she didn't disclose the private confidences I had shared with her, hinting that they would investigate my dad's medical practice, and even deposing my aunt, with whom I was eating dinner that night. And all because the man in the hat, standing in front of me, had decided that a frightened young woman could be useful in his larger case against the President of the United States. Understandably, I was a bit thrown. It was also confusing for me to see Ken Starr as a human being. He was there, after all, with what appeared to be his family. I finally gathered my wits about me after an internal command of get it together. Though I wish I had made different choices back then, I stammered. I wish that you and your office had made different choices, too. In hindsight, I later realized, I was paving the way for him to apologize. But he didn't. He merely said, with the same inscrutable smile, I know, it was unfortunate. It had been nearly 20 years since 1998. The next month would mark the 20th anniversary of the Starr investigation expanding to include me. The 20th anniversary of my name becoming public for the first time. And the 20th anniversary of a horrible year that would almost end Clinton's presidency, consume the nation's attention, and alter the course of my life. If I have learned anything since then, it is that you cannot run away from who you are or from how you've been shaped by your experiences. Instead, you must integrate your past and present. As Salman Rushdie observed after the fatwa was issued against him, those who do not have power over the story that dominates their lives, power to retell it, rethink it, deconstruct it, joke about it, and change it as times change, truly are powerless, because they cannot think new thoughts. I have been working toward this realization for years. I have been trying to find that power, a particularly Sisyphean task for a person who has been gaslighted. To be blunt, I was diagnosed several years ago with post-traumatic stress disorder, mainly from the ordeal of having been publicly outed and ostracized back then. My trauma expedition has been long, arduous, painful, and expensive. And it's not over. I like to joke that my tombstone will read Mutatis Mutandis, with changes being made. But as I find myself reflecting on what happened, I've also come to understand how my trauma has been, in a way, a microcosm of a larger, national one. Both clinically and observationally, something fundamental changed in our society in 1998, and it is changing again as we enter the second year of the Trump presidency in a post-Cosby, Ailes, O'Reilly, Weinstein, Spacey, whoever is next world. The Starr investigation and the subsequent impeachment trial of Bill Clinton amounted to a crisis that Americans arguably endured collectively, some of us obviously more than others. It was a shambolic morass of a scandal that dragged on for 13 months, and many politicians and citizens became collateral damage, along with the nation's capacity for mercy, measure, and perspective. Certainly, the events of that year did not constitute a war or a terrorist attack or a financial recession. They didn't constitute a natural catastrophe or a medical pandemic or what experts refer to as big T traumas. But something had shifted nonetheless, and even after the Senate voted in 1999 to acquit President Clinton on two articles of impeachment, we could not escape the sense of upheaval and partisan division that lingered, settled in, and stayed. Maybe you remember or have heard stories about how the scandals saturated television and radio, newspapers, magazines, and the Internet, Saturday Night Live, and the Sunday morning opinion programs, dinner party conversation and water cooler discussions, late-night monologues and political talk shows, definitely the talk shows. In the Washington Post alone, there were 125 articles written about this crisis in just the first 10 days. Many parents felt compelled to discuss sexual issues with their children earlier than they might have wanted to. They had to explain why lying, even if the president did it, was not acceptable behavior. The press was navigating unexplored terrain, too. Anonymous sources seemed to emerge almost daily with new and often false or meaningless revelations. There was a new commingling of traditional news, talk radio, tabloid television, and online rumor mills. Fake news, anyone? With the introduction of the World Wide Web in 1992-93, and two new cable news networks, Fox News and MSNBC, in 1996. The lines began to blur between fact and opinion, news and gossip, private lives and public shaming. The Internet had become such a propulsive force, driving the flow of information, that when the Republican-led Judiciary Committee of the House of Representatives decided to publish Ken Starr's commission's findings online just 2 days after he had delivered them, it meant that, for me personally, every adult with a modem could instantaneously peruse a copy and learn about my private conversations, my personal musings, lifted from my home computer, and worse yet, my sex life. Americans, young and old, red and blue, watched day and night. We watched a beleaguered president and the embattled and often disenchanted members of the administration as they protected him. We watched a first lady and first daughter move through the year with grit and grace. We watched a special prosecutor get pilloried, though some thought he deserved it. We watched an American family, my family, as a mother was forced to testify against her child, and as a father was forced to take his daughter to be fingerprinted at the federal building. We watched the wholesale dissection of a young, unknown woman, me, who, due to legal quarantine, was unable to speak out on her own behalf. How, then, to get a handle today on what exactly happened back then? Next photo, amid a phalanx of photographers, Lewinsky heads to the federal building in L.A., May 1998. One useful viewpoint is that of cognitive linguist George Lakoff. In his book, Moral Politics, What Conservatives Know That Liberals Don't, Lakoff observes that the connective fiber of our country is often best represented through the metaphor of family. In other words, our founding fathers. Uncle Sam, the concept of sending our sons and daughters to war. Lakoff goes on to argue that for conservatives, the nation is conceptualized, implicitly and unconsciously, as a strict father family, and for liberals, as a nurturant parent family. Addressing the scandal itself, he asserts that Clinton was widely perceived as the naughty child, and that in line with the filial metaphor, a family matter had turned into an affair of state. Thus, in many ways, the crack in the foundation of the presidency was also a crack in our foundation at home. Moreover, the nature of the violation, an extramarital relationship, struck at the heart of one of humanity's most complicated moral issues, infidelity. You'll forgive me if I leave that topic right there. The result, I believe, was that in 1998, the person to whom we would typically turn for reassurance and comfort during a national crisis was remote and unavailable. The country, at that stage, had no consistent Rooseveltian voice of calm or reason or empathy to make sense of the chaos. Instead, our nurturer-in-chief, because of his own actions, as much as the subterfuge of his enemies, was a figurative absent father. As a society, we went through this together. And ever since, The scandal has had an epigenetic quality. As if our cultural DNA has slowly been altered to ensure its longevity. If you can believe it, there has been at least one significant reference in the press to that unfortunate spell in our history every day for the past 20 years. Every single day. The fog of 1998 has lodged in our consciousness for many reasons. The Clintons have remained pivotal political figures on the global stage. Their disparagement has been vigorously abetted by this vast right-wing conspiracy, as Hillary Clinton famously put it, and the Clinton presidency sagged into a bitter electoral deadlock. The contested Bush versus Gore showdown, which would usher in an era so turbulent that it would leave the lessons of the Clinton years altogether murky. In succession came the unthinkable, the attacks of September 11, 2001, protracted conflicts, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the Great Recession, a state of perpetual gridlock in Washington, and then the daily bedlam central to Trumpism. No matter how these subsequent events dwarfed the impeachment and subsumed our attention, maybe, just maybe, the long, unimpeded derivation of this drama ever since is partly the result of 1998 having been a year of unremitting crisis that we all endured but never actually resolved. A low-grade collective trauma, perhaps? I discussed this idea with psychologist Jack Saul, founding director of New York's International Trauma Studies Program, and author of Collective Trauma, Collective Healing. Collective trauma, he told me, usually refers to the shared injuries to a population's social ecology due to a major catastrophe or chronic oppression, poverty, and disease. While the events of 1998 in the United States do not fit neatly into such a definition, they may have led to some of the features we often associate with collective traumas, social rupturing, and a profound sense of distress. The challenging of long-held assumptions about the world and national identity, a constricted public narrative, and a process of scapegoating and dehumanization. Until recently, thank you, Harvey Weinstein, historians hadn't really had the perspective to fully process and acknowledge that year of shame and spectacle. And as a culture, we still haven't properly examined it, reframed it, integrated it, and transformed it. My hope, given the two decades that have passed, is that we are now at a stage where we can untangle the complexities and context, maybe even with a little compassion, which might help lead to an eventual healing and a systemic transformation. As Haruki Murakami has written, when you come out of the storm, you won't be the same person who walked in. That's what this storm's all about. Who were we then? Who are we now? I'm so sorry you were so alone. Those seven words undid me. They were written in a recent private exchange I had with one of the brave women leading the hashtag MeToo movement. Somehow, coming from her, a recognition of sorts on a deep, soulful level, they landed in a way that cracked me open and brought me to tears. Yes, I had received many letters of support in 1998, and yes, thank God, I had my family and friends to support me. But by and large, I had been alone, so very alone, publicly alone, abandoned most of all by the key figure in the crisis who actually knew me well and intimately. That I had made mistakes, on that we can all agree, but swimming in that sea of aloneness was terrifying. Isolation is such a powerful tool to the subjugator, and yet I don't believe I would have felt so isolated had it all happened today. One of the most inspiring aspects of this newly energized movement is the sheer number of women who have spoken up in support of one another. And the volume in numbers has translated into volume of public voice. Historically, he who shapes the story, and it is so often a he, creates the truth. But this collective rise in decibel level has provided a resonance for women's narratives. If the internet was a bête noire to me in 1998, its stepchild, social media, has been a savior for millions of women today, notwithstanding all the cyberbullying, online harassment, doxing, and slut-shaming. Virtually anyone can share her or his hashtag MeToo story and be instantly welcomed into a tribe. In addition, the democratizing potential of the internet to open up support networks and penetrate what used to be closed circles of power is something that was unavailable to me back then. Power, in that case, remained in the hands of the president and his minions, the Congress, the prosecutors, and the press. There are many more women and men whose voices and stories need to be heard before mine. There are even some people who feel my White House experiences don't have a place in this movement, as what transpired between Bill Clinton and myself was not sexual assault, although we now recognize that it constituted a gross abuse of power. And yet, everywhere I have gone for the past few months, I've been asked about it. My response has been the same. I am in awe of the sheer courage of the women who have stood up and begun to confront entrenched beliefs and institutions. But as for me, my history, and how I fit in personally, I'm sorry to say I don't have a definitive answer yet on the meaning of all the events that led to the 1998 investigation. I am unpacking and reprocessing what happened to me over and over and over again. For 2 decades, I have been working on myself, my trauma, and my healing. And naturally, I have grappled with the rest of the world's interpretations and Bill Clinton's reinterpretations of what happened. But in truth, I have done this at arm's length. There have been so many barriers to this place of self-reckoning. The reason this is difficult is that I've lived for such a long time in the house of gaslight, clinging to my experiences as they unfolded in my 20s, and railing against the untruths that painted me as an unstable stalker and servicer-in-chief. An inability to deviate from the internal script of what I actually experienced left little room for reevaluation. I cleaved to what I knew. So often have I struggled with my own sense of agency versus victimhood. In 1998, we were living in times in which women's sexuality was a marker of their agency, owning desire. And yet, I felt that if I saw myself as in any way a victim, it would open the door to choruses of, "See, you did merely service him." What it means to confront a long-held belief, one clung to like a life raft in the middle of the ocean, is to challenge your own perceptions and allow the pentimento painting that is hidden beneath the surface to emerge and be seen in the light of a new day. Given my PTSD and my understanding of trauma, it's very likely that my thinking would not necessarily be changing at this time had it not been for the hashtag MeToo movement. Not only because of the new lens it has provided, but also because of how it has offered new avenues toward the safety that comes from solidarity. Just 4 years ago, in an essay for this magazine, I wrote the following. Sure, My boss took advantage of me, but I will always remain firm on this point. It was a consensual relationship. Any abuse came in the aftermath, when I was made a scapegoat in order to protect his powerful position. I now see how problematic it was that the two of us even got to a place where there was a question of consent. Instead, the road that led there was littered with inappropriate abuse of authority, station, and privilege. Full stop. Now, at 44, I'm beginning, just beginning, to consider the implications of the power differentials that were so vast between a president and a White House intern. I'm beginning to entertain the notion that in such a circumstance, the idea of consent might well be rendered moot. Although power imbalances and the ability to abuse them do exist even when the sex has been consensual, but it's also complicated, very, very complicated. The dictionary definition of consent: to give permission for something to happen. And yet, what did the something mean in this instance, given the power dynamics, his position, and my age? Was the something just about crossing a line of sexual and later emotional intimacy? An intimacy I wanted, with a 22-year-old's limited understanding of the consequences. He was my boss. He was the most powerful man on the planet. He was 27 years my senior, with enough life experience to know better. He was, at the time, at the pinnacle of his career, while I was in my first job out of college. Note to the trolls, both Democratic and Republican, none of the above excuses me for my responsibility for what happened. I meet regret every day. This, sigh, is as far as I've gotten in my reevaluation. I want to be thoughtful, but I know one thing for certain. Part of what has allowed me to shift is knowing I'm not alone anymore, and for that I am grateful. We owe a huge debt of gratitude to the hashtag MeToo and Time's Up heroines. They are speaking volumes against the pernicious conspiracies of silence that have long protected powerful men when it comes to sexual assault, sexual harassment, and abuse of power. Thankfully, Time's Up is addressing the need women have for financial resources to help defray the huge legal cost involved in speaking out. But there is another cost to consider. For many, the reckoning has also been a re-triggering. Sadly, what I see with every new allegation and with every posting of hashtag MeToo is another person who may have to cope with the re-emergence of trauma. My hope is that through Time's Up, or perhaps another organization, we can begin to meet the need for the resources that are required for the kind of trauma therapy vital for survival and recovery. Regrettably, it's often only the privileged who can afford the time and the money to get the help they deserve. Through all of this, during the past several months, I have been repeatedly reminded of a powerful Mexican proverb: they tried to bury us. They didn't know we were seeds. Spring has finally sprung.
Thank you.
From A.M. Holmes comes this Vanity Fair spotlight, Triple Thread. With photograph by Mackenzie Stroh, Laurie Metcalf, Glenda Jackson, and Allison Pill, photographed in New York City. Among the most autobiographical of Edward Albee's plays, Three Tall Women makes its Broadway debut this spring. The production, directed by Joe Mantello and produced by Scott Rudin, is an all-star trifecta featuring Allison Pill, Laurie Metcalf, and the inimitable Glenda Jackson, who is returning to the Great White Way after a 30-year absence, during which she served as a member of the British Parliament. It is so uncommon to have three tall women exist in the theater, Metcalf observes. It's interesting because built into this play is a kind of hierarchy. We all bow to Glenda Jackson. I just want to be present to absorb what she's doing. The Pulitzer Prize-winning play captures three women in various stages of life, youth, middle age, and old age. It is a surgically precise portrait of a woman's relationship with herself, an excavation turned meditation on life as it nears its end, who we are, who we have become, and how we remember ourselves, Pill says. Albee famously wrote fiercely strong, if sometimes terrifying, female characters, drawing inspiration from his adoptive mother, Frances, who was both his monster and inevitably his muse. The playwright, who died in 2016 at age 88, allows for the darkly comic unpacking of a matriarch's vulnerability and the burden of a life spent being vilified for her indomitable spirit. He and his adoptive mother didn't get on, says Jackson. I think I'm putting it rather mildly. In fact, Albee's introduction to the play terminates with him saying he rarely met anyone who could abide her, though many who have seen the play find her fascinating. He culminates by saying, "Heavens, what have I done?" the life he designed. From a small family business in the Italian village of Cassettetete, where his grandfather had been a cobbler, Diego Delle Valle has built the international fashion brand Tod's and acquired all the amenities befitting a mogul. James Reginato learns what inspires the man known as DDV to refine and expand his world. Opening photo, Soul Man. Diego Delle Valle in this photo with son Emmanuel, grandson Jack, nephew Matteo Procaccioli, father Dorino, and brother Andrea in Cassettetete, Italy, 2011. Photographs for this article are by Jonathan Becker. Tutti sotto controllo. Everything's under control, Diego Delle Valle observed contentedly, to no one in particular, on a bright, recent morning as he strolled into Rome's Colosseum, which was empty except for a photography crew busily preparing to take his portrait. Off-hours access inside Italy's most famous monument is a nice perk that comes with a fledgling with pledging $34 million for its restoration. As Delle Valle, president and CEO of the Tod's Group, one of Italy's leading fashion brands, did in 2011. In 2016, the Tod's donation also allowed Delle Valle to host at the landmark one of the most splendid dinners Rome has seen since the Caesars. To celebrate the completion of Phase 1 of the project, in which the building's soot-covered travertine was painstakingly cleaned with purified water and returned to its original creamy pink hue, Delle Valle invited 300 guests for dinner at candle-lit tables perched on the upper tier of the ancient amphitheater. Prime Minister Matteo Renzi sat with Delle Valle. The menu, shrimp risotto, sea bass, and wild fruits. As Zubin Mehta conducted the orchestra from Milan's La Scala Opera House, the interior of the arena was aglow in red, white, and green, the colors of the Italian flag. The work is expected to continue for another 5 or 6 years. With a reported $1.8 billion fortune, Delle Valle beams with satisfaction as he talks about being able to make such a significant philanthropic gift. Our success was made in Italy. We have to give back. You can't forget social responsibility, he says. A few years ago, Delle Valle fondly recalled his first trip to the Colosseum. To a reporter from the Wall Street Journal, he was 11 years old, in a school bus packed with noisy classmates from his hometown, Cassettetete, a village in the Marche region on Italy's Adriatic coast. Threading through the Apennine mountain range, the drive to Rome took more than 8 hours. Today, at age 64, Delle Valle makes the trip from Cassettetete, still his home, in half an hour, thanks to his Augusta Westland AW-139 helicopter and Gulfstream G550 jet. Next photo, a dog's life. Villa Palambarone, Delle Valle's 370-acre estate in Cassettetete, home to his golden retriever Ettore. DDV, as friends sometimes refer to him, was born into relatively modest circumstances. His grandfather, Filippo, cobbled shoes at night in a kitchen workroom. During the day, he peddled them in open-air marketplaces in towns throughout central Italy that he reached by train. After World War II, DDV's father, Dorino, built on this legacy by opening a small shoemaking factory. As a baby, DDV often napped there on a bed of animal hides assembled by his mother, Maria. Before he was a teenager, he was helping out on the factory floor when he wasn't in school. In the 1960s, the Delhi Valley factory prospered, manufacturing shoes for private labels, including the department stores Saks Fifth Avenue and Bergdorf Goodman. Following Dorino's wishes, Diego left home and enrolled in law school at the University of Bologna. But it was not a good fit. "I followed girls more than books," explains Diego. In 1975, he persuaded his father to take him into the family business. He began taking trips to New York, carrying bags of samples to show to buyers and marketers. Soon, he landed deals to make shoes for designers such as Calvin Klein, Azzedine Alaia, and Jeffrey Bean. "The thing that amazed me about New York was if you had a good idea, you could do a deal in a day," he recalled to The New Yorker in 2004. Diego Della Valle's turning point came at the end of the 1970s, on the heels, as it were, of a moccasin-like driving shoe that he had perfected and christened the Gomino, after the 133 little gummy bumps on its leather sole. The combination of rubber, then considered cheap and déclassé, with the fine leather that Della Valle used for the rest of the shoe, not only produced a pair of gloves for the feet, as DDV says, but also set the direction for the company, with its fusion of Italian and Anglo-American style, the casual with the dressy, and its emphasis on top-quality materials used with restraint. "I prefer quality to luxury," he says. "Luxury can become tacky when it's too much. You have to have the perfect mix of good taste and charm." Marketing savvy was also crucial. Orders for the Gomino started pouring in after it was seen on the feet of Gianni Agnelli, the late Fiat titan and international style icon. Diego had gotten his friend Luca di Montezemolo, a protege of Agnelli's, to deliver a pair. DDV took over the Delhi Valley shoemaking business and in 1984 renamed it J.P. Todd's. He has affably denied the story that he picked the name out of a Boston phone book, but he did want something that sounded Anglo-American and that would be easy for people around the world to pronounce. The J.P. was dropped in 1997. With drive and moxie, Diego began building his empire. "When I was a little kid, if I got up in the middle of the night, I'd find my dad sitting at the kitchen table with a mountain of papers. We lived in just a simple house then," remembers DDV's elder son, Emmanuel, 42. "There were stacks of shoeboxes," he recalls, "with notes stuck onto them, bearing names such as Harrison Ford, Sharon Stone, and Lee Iacocca." Celebrities to whom his father planned to send the shoes as gifts. This was before swag, before everybody started giving things away. The celebrities loved it. They would send him back photos of themselves and notes. "Dear Mr. Della Valle, I love your shoes," says Emmanuel, who worked in a variety of capacities for Todd's before becoming a filmmaker with last year's Wetlands. His mother, Simona, is divorced from Diego. Her sister, Barbara Pistelli, is Diego's third wife, with whom he has a son, Filippo, 20. Before long, royals and celebrities alike were being seen in Todd's footwear or carrying one of the bags the company started producing. Among them were Princess Diana, a big supporter. "She loved our products," says DDV. "King Juan Carlos of Spain. We spent hours talking about shoes. He knows everything about shoes." Princess Caroline of Monaco, Julia Roberts, JFK Jr., Tom Cruise, George Clooney, Tom Hanks, and Hillary Clinton, who carried a Todd's bag when she was first lady. Sales exploded in the late 80s, and growth has continued at an astonishing rate. Ready to Wear was introduced in 2006. More recently, Todd's products have been seen on the likes of Jessica Chastain, Kate Blanchett, Benedict Cumberbatch, the Duchess of Cambridge, and Kendall Jenner, the face of Todd's Spring 2018 ad campaign. Annual sales of Todd's Group products have passed the $1 billion mark. Diego and his younger brother, Andrea, 52, who is vice president, own a 61% stake in the company, which was listed on the Milan Stock Exchange in 2000. Outside of the Todd's Group, DDV has made sizable personal investments in some of Italy's most iconic brands, including the film studio Cinecittà, Vespa maker Piaggio, and the soccer team AC Fiorentina, which he and Andrea rescued from bankruptcy in 2002. 11 years ago, with his old friend Luca di Montemizzolo, then the chairman of Ferrari, and a small handful of other visionary Italian businessmen, he started Italo NTV, the country's first private high-speed rail company. When I consider an investment, I look for companies that sell dream ideas, says Diego. He's the Gianni Agnelli of today, says billionaire investor and philanthropist Ronald Perelman. He's smart, values friendships, and he's a great businessman with a brilliant eye. It's the balance of his strengths and priorities that sets him apart, notes Nicole Kidman. He's such a Renaissance man who cares culturally and artistically, she says, and he is a family man at his core, as well as a great businessman. Today, he's still the same guy I remember from when I was a kid. He's still doing the same things. It's just that the square footage has changed, says Emmanuel. Quite some time ago, the Della Valle family moved out of their modest home in Cassette and into the 370-acre Villa Palambaron, the most substantial estate in the vicinity, which had been owned by the local grandee Count Brancadoro. As children, Diego and his friends used to sneak into the grounds to play until they were shooed out by caretakers. Around the original structure of a monastery that had been founded here circa 1100, an imposing villa was built circa 1500, which the Della Valleys have only continued to improve upon. Barbara, an architect, directs the design work. Indoor and outdoor pools, a spa, a screening room, a guest house, a regulation-size soccer pitch, and, of course, a helipad are just some of the present-day amenities. There are five other Della Valle residences, a penthouse atop the 19th-century Art Deco Palazzo that houses Todd's headquarters in Milan, an apartment in the Carlisle in New York, a waterfront villa bought from Billy Joel on La Gorge Island in Miami Beach, a four-story maison particulière with an indoor pool in the 7th arrondissement of Paris, and a glorious 12-acre compound on Capri. Nobody said stop, comments Della Valle about his real estate acquisitions. He spends several weeks in Miami over the winter months and frequents Capri in spring and summer. He shuttles back and forth among all the other residences. When we speak about our homes, well, everything becomes much more complicated, says Barbara, who designed all these residences. Often my client wants to be the architect. He makes incomprehensible drawings. He hurries me in any choice I have to make, saying that I am too slow. Sometimes he has brilliant intuitions, I have to admit. Other times, less so. Often we come to loggerheads, and we do not talk to each other for a few days. But, she adds, they do kiss and make up. After all, our idea of home is the same, and wherever it is and whatever its architecture looks like, it remains the place we love to share with our family and is always open to our dear friends. Villa Margherita, the Capri property, features a castle-like country house with a 15th-century tower built by Carthusian monks, which was previously owned by Axel Munthe, the renowned Swedish physician. Barbara oversaw a 5-year renovation of the estate that involved Herculean feats of restoration and construction. It is now a paradise, with 3 guest houses, plus the requisite pool, spa, tennis court, and soccer pitch, along with gardens and a vineyard where vegetables are grown and a white wine is produced for the family's consumption. Considering the astronomical cost of real estate on Capri, this might be the world's most expensive to produce wine. Diego puts a high premium on food and drink. Baskets of tomatoes, artichokes, arugula, and other produce grown at Villa Margherita or Villa Palembaron fly with him on his jet to supply his tables in Paris and Milan. "It's important to know what we are eating," he says. He also makes, at a property he owns in Tuscany, an excellent red wine, a blend of Sangiovese and Merlot named Dorino, after his father. Beyond the real estate, there is Della Valle's fleet. The exteriors of his chopper and his jet are painted in DDV's signature yellow and green striped livery, which also adorns his luggage and many of his other accoutrements. Inside, the upholstery is of glove-soft leather. Derek Lamb, a former creative director for Todd's, once said that flying in Diego's helicopter was like being in a handbag. Best of all may be the boats. The Altair III, a 194-foot, 8-stateroom yacht, and the Marlin. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock, Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock, Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.